I'm very pleased to welcome to the program today Martez Paris. Martez, to say a few words about her, holds a BA and a BA honours as well as a master's from the University of Sheffield. She's an assistant lecturer within the Library and Information Studies section of the Centre for Communication Technology and lectures on the Diploma in Library and Information Studies course, which is a very popular diploma, both for professionals in the area of library studies and also for other people who are simply interested in learning more about libraries and how they work. At present, she's working very hard as a PhD candidate with the University College London. Thank you, Martez, for finding the time with all your studies and your work to come over for a chat with me today.
My pleasure.
I'll call you Martez, if you don't mind.
Of course.
Somebody who lives books on a daily basis in their work must have a sort of a special relationship with them. Do you manage to separate the professional from the personal? Do you have what the Italians call deformazione professionale, always looking at books with their professional point of view?
Not really, no. I can well understand this question because I've chosen a book entitled The Story of Libraries, and one would think that I only read libraries. Not really the case. I do read fiction, all types of fiction. However, I chose this particular book because although as much as I'm into IT and the internet particularly, I like to go a bit against the tide, the grain, and because many people think that now with internet we should all do away with libraries, and I do not
subscribe
to that idea at all. I think libraries properly funded and professionally run are still very valid. And I think that their story should be heard, and a story which is still unfolding, really.
In fact, I was really delighted when you came up with this idea of this book to focus upon, because what I'm trying to do in this series, Talking Books, is to bring in people who have different backgrounds, different approaches to books, different reasons for using the books, and we've heard from people who have a favourite book, perhaps was a childhood volume, and we've spoken about that. We've spoken about the Booker Prize, which I hope Wilhelm mentioned as well today, because I think it's an important issue. So I was interested to have this choice from somebody who's a professional in the field and who sort of was going to tell us about a little bit about where books come from. So what were the original libraries like? Where did they originate? Who created them?
Well, ironically, the origin of library lies in the keeping of written records. We librarians look towards that. Going back to about 5,000 years ago, where records were kept in Babylonia and even in today's Iraq, per se. And then, of course, around the 7th century, before the Common Era, you even had thousands of tablets bearing ownerships, seals of ownership, records again being kept. However, the very first libraries, as we would understand them today, originated in Greece, of course. There were libraries set up next to temples, but you even have private libraries, like that, of course, of Aristotle himself, who was then to influence the Egyptians in building what is arguably the most popular library, the Alexandrina Library.
Finished badly.
Yes, it finished badly in the hands of a later emperor and even the hands of Christians, who also sacked the daughter library. But at the time of Julius Caesar, it had 700,000 papyrus scrolls, because there was this whole movement of trying to get all the knowledge of the world into this library. Mm-hmm. Recently, as we know, in 2002, it reopened again with funds from UNESCO, and even Malta actually contributed to it.
Really?
It gave copies of manuscripts relating to the Ottoman Empire from the National Library.
But these libraries would have been, yes, sort of somebody wanting to collect all the knowledge of the world in one place, but they would have been obviously manuscripts, obviously on papyrus or some other material. And who would have had access, though, to those kind of libraries? Just the person who created them?
All the scholars and the students of people like Aristotle and Plato, you know. I mean, obviously, even when we speak later on about further on during the time of the monasticism in Europe, where you had monasteries and scribes and writing and rewriting these scrolls. Obviously, I mean, it wasn't just a white, you know, the common man would not actually have been literate
enough, anyway, so.
And wouldn't have had that much interest in this. But you'll find that with time, libraries developed in line with the education system. In fact, coming closer to our times, the first important libraries were that associated with universities, like the University of Bologna, Paris, Oxford, Cambridge, which started obviously because there was a market then, and the there was the reproduction of books, mm-hmm. Handwritten books.
So after the great libraries of Greece and Egypt, then how did they evolve? They evolved then, as you're saying, through the universities. They became more common in, I would imagine, monasteries and that sort of thing.
Yes, yes. What you had was that in the first and the second century, you had the development of the codex. That is the book as we know it today, not in rolls and scrolls. And the Christians were partly responsible for that. Mm-hmm. And then you had the setting up of these monasteries. You had the Monte Cassino monastery and other monasteries even further in south of Italy. And yes, with time you had these universities being set up. And then of course we had the great breakthrough by Gutenberg himself, who invented and started printing in movable types.
Because one has to imagine that the writing by hand went on for over 1,500 years.
Yes,
we're talking just AD,
of course.
In previous centuries.
Yes, of course.
So Gutenberg was the great moment.
Yes, yes. In fact, after Gutenberg, there was a whole spread of printing houses being set up in various spots in Germany and Italy, Bamberg, Nuremberg, Venice, Basel. And this happened because this brought labor costs down and production actually increased, and more people were... of course, this coincided also with the Renaissance, and there was more learning and people were more... open to books and learning.
In a way, it was a democratizing process because it was a possibility then to have many more copies, obviously made, and therefore the spread could be better across Europe, across the world.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Did this then change? Was there a sort of a sea change in the attitude of people to books and learning? Did this democratization change the look of the uses that a book could be put to at this point?
Yes. I would say again, however, that one of the important agents of change were actually the universities that were set up in different parts of Europe. And even in America, you had in the 17th century then Harvard, the origin of the Ivy League, being set up, and with that there was a market, because I mean printing presses had no place in the world unless people were actually buying the books.
When did the first lending libraries really come into existence? Because at the moment, you know, until now we've spoken about the university ones, where probably it was at least selected use, if not reference only, kind of how we would refer to as reference only now. When did people actually start going to a library and borrowing a book, taking it home.
Well,
with
I would say, that mid 19th century, 1850, there was the Public Libraries Act in the UK, so that started the whole process. But in actual fact, we even find references to Cicero's time in Rome lending books to. I will, again, we're not talking about the general public here, you know.
His own friends and
yes,
associates
exactly.
Who would have been
yes,
literate.
Yes, but that started off, and we also had the setting up of the American Library Association in 1861, which started setting standards for public libraries and other types of libraries, and the whole process started over. From then onwards.
Certainly in UK, I remember that my own hometown, the public library was a focal point of the whole town. It was actually very much in the centre of the town, part and parcel of the assembly hall, the council offices. It was really considered a key place in our town, which was a provincial town in the south of England.
Well, I would say that hasn't really much changed in Britain or the US, where libraries are seen as a public good, you know, they're part of community. And I think as well, because they do have better funding than in other countries, they carry out general service to the community. For instance, the public library is seen as a place where to get information even about citizen rights. The public library is seen as a place where children, even after school, are not only told stories, and there are the mother and child clubs, but are actually also helped with their schoolwork. Because, you know, not everyone can find help at home. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, of course, with the introduction of the internet, librarians are there to help people even to get the right information, because, as we know, not everything that Google brings up is actually something to trust. Mm-hmm. However, libraries in Britain are really, you know, quite involved in helping community, different sectors of the community.
The idea of the public good in the mid-1800s sort of goes a bit hand in hand with the idea of the museum as well being mm-hmm. a public
exactly.
good. And very often the architecture of the building itself is sending messages to that end, really.
Yes, of course. In fact, you see, of course, libraries have been renovated even nowadays, even abroad, and you know, library architecture is seen something as quite exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, even here, our own university library, the first floor, has been changed and has been, you know, quite popular, I think, with the students.
Mm-hmm. As we head towards the digital library, if we are heading towards the digital library, how are things going to change for the provider and for the user? Really?
Yes, well, with the digital library, which does exist, and we are heading there, you will find that the librarian has to adapt to a different medium now of communicating with people. People may not come to the library, but could actually use the library. There is this term library without walls, where people actually tap into the resources from the library website, which needs to be, of course, very interactive. And it needs a lot of preparation, a lot of work. The librarian can't just sit there anymore and wait for people to come in through the door, but to answer queries online, to answer queries via email or chats, and that requires a lot of preparation and training. Furthermore, of course, as we know, there are now sources such as websites and even journal material which is available online. But even for the public library, the digital library would be a library which is a website which gives information to the citizen, to people who need information, how to look for information. The library now is moving more towards information literacy, that is helping people, training them and giving them the right skills to look for information in the right way, to be discerning about the information that they come across, even on the internet, how to judge the authorship and the provenance of information.
This is going to require, in the public sector, I suppose, a lot of investment, both of hard cash and also human resources.
Yes, indeed. And I think that it's important that we librarians actually make people aware of what were the proper funding and the right resources. These things can actually benefit the community if we do want to have a well-informed and well-educated community. I mean, gone are the days when you went to school or university and said, right, okay, now that's it, done. It's important really that people continue with their own education and to be more adaptable to developments in economy and
the workplace
and society.
As well.
Yes.
Yes, the key words, sort of continuing, long life, lifelong education, these are buzzwords that we keep talking about. But it's actually probably a library out in the community or here, say, at a university, is going to play a key role in that, in the possibility of doing that, because you can have an online course, but somehow or other you're going to have to read the literature. So whether it's going to be a book or whether it's going to be
online.
Of course, it depends on one's possibilities. But more and more, I suppose, is going to be online.
Yes, I mean the advantage of libraries over the individual is that libraries will manage to acquire those sources and resources like databases and access to information which the normal individual would find it too expensive to acquire. That's where libraries come in useful. I mean, this is like books. I mean, you can't really buy all the books, but that's why libraries are there, so that you can borrow different books, but at the same time with online resources. The important thing is that libraries need to keep abreast with where education is heading, with where information needs of the community is heading.
Mm-hmm. With educational books, I mean, it was ever thus in the sense that you have books that are updated on a regular basis, so that the libraries have to get the latest edition. I don't know, a law book. You can't have a law book of 2000 or medicine, or IT, even worse.
Yes.
You have to have the latest one. So that is important. And it's the same obviously goes for the digital side of things.
Of course, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to digress a bit from books, when it comes to journals, I mean, no publisher like Elsevier is going to, I mean, you can get individual membership, but that's pretty expensive. And what you do is actually you never really acquire the material, but you actually have a license to access the material. And that's an ongoing expense, a recurring expense. And that's where libraries come in, because mm-hmm. the individual might not be able to afford that.
A word from somebody who wasn't brought up in the early years in the digital age, the archiving side of things, digital archiving, I would worry. I like to have a book in my hand that I know that I can go in 50 years' time, and unless the worms have got to it, it'll still be there. What about the data archiving? Are there dangers there?
Yes, I would say yes, up to an extent. We just were talking about journals. This is something that libraries have to consider. When you buy a journal in print form, it's there on your shelf, and it can remain there as much as you want it to. When you buy a license to access journals, you're buying so many number of years. So if you're just buying today with an archive of 5 years, every year the archive is moving with you. So what you had today, five years, so you're losing access. But I think you're referring mostly to the the damage that can happen even on digital.
As well. Yeah.
Well, I mean, first of all, you could have websites where the average age of a website is about 40 days. There are websites which have been there since last year.
Uh-huh.
But then you've got, of course, the media websites which change by the minute.
Mm-hmm.
Several countries have actually embarked on a archiving program. The major ones are Sweden, Australia, and even Britain and France. And they are looking at different models. Some of them are harvesting the whole web, say the whole Swedish web, and others are going, because it's not really that expensive, but others are going more towards selective archiving. But again, you know, I mean, what with technology? I mean, somebody could wake up tomorrow and come up with some bright idea and create a total paradigm shift to what we have now. I mean, nobody uses floppy disks anymore.
Quite.
I mean, no computers come with floppy disks. Mm-hmm. And the fear is that they will invent something. I mean, they already have. People are using mobile phones now and PDAs. How are you going to store the information there?
As far as the future is concerned, you see libraries with a sort of a dual purpose, the book, the solid book there on the shelf, and the digital approach.
Oh yes, I think that scenario is already here, especially in libraries, say Britain. You can walk into a library of Victoria Station and there's one hall filled with monitors and screens, people accessing internet on a Saturday morning for free, because this is something that the general public might not realize, the value of having a library, that you can go there and access resources for free. And then you have the other side, a part of the library filled with books, DVDs, CD-ROMs, and other stuff. And that's already happening.
I think that public libraries, the fact that they're still there today means that people still do read. And I suppose that people who are working in this area are always trying to find ways and means of measuring how much people are reading. In recent years, there seems, despite the digital evolution, there seems to have been a lot of enthusiasm for reading still, or reading books, both on the side of the children and of adults. How do you explain that?
Well, recently there was a publication by the Observer literary reviewer, Robert McCroom, who said that there were a number of things that actually created this shift, this whole resurgence towards reading. And ironically, I will mention one of them. It was actually things that happened on the internet, such as Amazon, which made it so easy for people to purchase books anywhere in the world. I mean, if you read about a review of a book in a British newspaper, you can just turn around and order it and have it there within a few days. But there were other things, such as a new crop of young authors such as Zadie Smith, who was actually advanced £250,000 on her first manuscript, which turned out to be a bestseller as well. And people like Andrea Levy, for instance. But then as well, you had other established authors such as Ian McEwan, who made a success with Amsterdam, but then what it was actually his book, which was turned into a film at the moment.
Atonement,
that's it, that actually got people into this disorder.
J.K. Rowling, of course.
Yes, I was
Not
coming to
forget
to her.
The children.
Yes, in fact, she was probably the person who actually got the whole reading trend moving again, because you even had, by the third book, you even had adults as well as children looking out for her book. You even had Bloomsbury creating a different cover, an adult cover, so that people couldn't be seen reading Harry Potter on the train. But there were other things as well, such as festivals and book clubs being set up.
In fact, in Rikyuan, I mean, with the Booker Prize. As
yes,
well,
exactly, and prizes such as the Orange Prize and the Booker Prize, mm-hmm. And finally, even quite recently, people are actually looking at Kindle, the device, the e-book device produced by Amazon. And they are saying that possibly not people like us who enjoy having a book in our hand, but the other generation who are totally technology-minded and love having these little games in their hands would probably find that also useful and to continue this popularity towards books.
And a final word before we go. When you curl up on the sofa in the evening with a book in your hand, what kind of book is it?
Well, recently I've been reading books written by women from different cultures. I think I spoke about this before. One of my favorite books, which I recently reread, was a book by a Moroccan writer, Fatima Merisi. It's called Tales of Moroccan Childhood. She's now a sociology professor at University of Fez, but she speaks about her childhood within a harem. She is the daughter of the second son, so they all live in this house, but her uncle being the firstborn, his family has a sort of more privileged place in the household. And she is brought up in this extended family environment. The book is a delightful book because she writes through the eyes of a child. For instance, she speaks about the French and the Germans, because this is 1940s, and why they are so angry and arrogant. And she says, we know because Allah did not give them enough sun. That's why they are short-tempered, you know. but it's sweet. And I love reading books written by people from different cultures. At the moment, I'm reading, I mentioned her before, Andrea Levy's Small Island, which I had bought a couple of years ago. Never found her. And now I've picked it up again.
Thank you very, very much, Martes Faris, for coming to talk to us today about libraries, about where they're going, and a little bit about your own taste as well. My guest today was Martes Faris. Do join me again next week, when I shall be speaking to Michael Rosner. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.